Shalom, Yoho Rengekyo. Thanks for being here. New day, new Gosho. We're starting with Letter to Horen. And for a little background, Horen's birth name was Soya Kyoshin. He was a practitioner of Nichiren's Doctrine of the Lotus Sutra, and had been for about 15 years until he decided, actually converted in 1260, and around 1271 he became a lay monk, or a teaching monk amongst the people. Sorry, forgot to move the microphone. Anyway, at least I caught it early this time. So, as a lay monk, he was given the title or a name change, which is the custom for centuries in Japan and China. When you took to the ordination platform to take your vows, your Buddhist vows, you were given a new name to honor your stature as a learned individual, somebody who could teach others well. So when he did that, Nichiren bestowed upon him the Buddhist name Horen, which means law lotus. The letter is addressed to Horen because at the time Soya Kyoshin was acting as a teacher of Lotus Sutra, Nichiren's Doctrine of the Lotus Sutra. And so because it is this kind of a letter, it's a teaching to a teacher. So it's a teaching to somebody who's already quite well read. These types of letters either have very doctrinal, in-depth conversations about the nature of the teaching in relation to outside the teachings, non-Buddhists, or really most of the time, because of the conditions in Japan at the time, it's more of a debate-oriented teaching that teaches about how these other sects that are attacking Nichiren are founded on erroneous or incorrect doctrine or interpretation of doctrine. So again, Nichiren, the scholar, is always engaging his inner circle, and by extension into the public, the lay monks, information on how to understand their own practice and how to repel the false arguments and erroneous arguments from outside, from other schools of thought, right? Or schools of Buddhism. So in this case, it's not so debate oriented. It's not so, but there's still what the lay monk is dealing with, as opposed to the inner circle of disciples around Nichiren, is that the inner circle are engaged in active debate in the public with these other schools, true words and so forth, and the rulers of the respective areas of Japan. So those people are engaged in very scholarly debate, and that affects the governance and the future political support of these of Nichiren's and the Lotus Sutra's teachings, right? So there's a different kind of teaching that goes to them, those people who are Nichiren's extension, if you will. And the lay monk, who is just amongst the populace, the nature of that monk's scholarship would be much more intimate with people's struggles regarding the true word school, or their father's disavowal of them, or you know, these issues that are either direct experience, I'm going through this, how do I practice, to I'm practicing and I'm trying to be a good Nichiren Buddhist, but my friends are all true word Buddhists, and or my you know, my my boyfriend practices Shinto practices, and you know, and so forth. So they're dealing with similar issues, but on a much more personal basis, right? So the advice, therefore, is tailored more personally. So, again, I'm still suffering from that dry mouth thing. I apologize. If I don't lubricate, my tongue will stick to the roof of my mouth. So, apologies. One of the things that Nichiren addresses here is that he's responding to a letter that he's received from, I guess we'll just call him Horen, about a dedication in his practice to honor his recently deceased father. And so Nichiren, it's actually what he's doing is a portion of Gangyo. So it's interesting to read in that respect is how the practice of Gangyo formed over the years. We've already touched on that, but it's in this letter as well. Anyway, without further ado, let me just get into it and we'll discuss it as I go. But I just wanted to give you a tiny bit of background. The teacher of the law chapter in the fourth volume of the Lotus Sutra states, if there should be an evil person who, his mind destitute of goodness, should for the space of a kalpa appear in the presence of the Buddha and constantly curse and revile the Buddha, that person's offense would still be rather light. But if there were a person who spoke only one evil word to curse or defame the lay persons or monks or nuns who read and recite the Lotus Sutra, then his offense would be very grave. So he's making a distinction here between somebody who just doesn't understand Buddhism and they just haven't cultivated the desire for a life free of suffering, a joyful life, or a life to attain their greatest potential. They're either ignorant of it completely, or they don't know about it. And they meet Buddha, whether it's Shakyamuni Buddha or you and I in our Buddha, our Bodhisattva life condition. Specifically, these teachings are all expurgations of the provisional earlier teachings and so forth. So they're always referencing the Buddha, Shakyamuni. But it's a more general statement as well. Anyway, then that's a bad cause, but to them they're just insulting some guy. Maybe not just some guy because he's wearing robes. Okay, he's a monk guy, but they don't have any idea what they're insulting or cursing, right? But if someone who knows you or knows that you're practicing this Buddhism, now you're not just some guy, but you're somebody who practices Buddhism, and they curse or revile you because you practice Buddhism, that is a much deeper matter. Because without being conscious of it, they are defiling their own potential for Buddhahood. See, this is always the lens through which Buddhist expedient means looks at the world, right? We'll go on. The great teacher Miao Lo commented on this, quote, "The benefits conferred by this sutra are lofty, and its principles are the highest. Therefore, this statement is made with regard to it. Nothing like this is said about any other sutra." So this is Miao Lo's comment on that quote from the teacher of the law. Follow? With regard to the meaning of this sutra passage, the definition of a kalpa is as follows. All right, so you can see this is some fundamental teachings for a lay monk, right? And all of us would be keen to know, what is this kalpa thing? Suppose that the span of a human life is 80,000 years. That's a long time. And that it decreases 1 year every 100 years. Holy crap. Or 10 years every 1,000 years. So it's 80,000 years, but it's not regular years. It's 80,000 years when you calculate the years. One tenth? 1 year every 100 years. So 1/100th every year. So you'd have to multiply 80,000 years by 100 for the full lifespan as compares to our regular lifespan. Buddhism loves to play with numbers like this. So let's just read on and see if we can't get the intent of this example, right? Let us suppose that it decreases at this rate until the lifespan has reached 10 years. At this point, a person 10 years old would be like an 80-year-old man of today. Then the process would reverse, and after 100 years, the lifespan would increase to 11 years. So take a whole 100 years to increase your lifespan, 1 year of 80,000 years. This is going to go on for a while. And after another 100 years, to 12 years. After 1,000 years, it would have increased to 20 years. And this would continue until it once more reached 80,000 years. The time required to complete this combined process of decrease and increase is called a kalpa. All right, so this is just unfathomable, right? So now he's saying that this 80,000 years is something that's construed back and forth 1 year at a time, and every year takes 100 years to complete. By the time you're done doing the math, you're into some billions of years. Now he says, there are various other definitions of kalpa, but for the time being, I will use the word kalpa in the sense defined above. Oh, so kalpa isn't a clearly defined actual number. It's, again, a metaphorical concept of how we experience time, but not time itself. And that's a key feature of Buddhism. You have to keep that in mind. That's why when we talk about previous lives, future lives, extra lifetimes, this is all contemporaneous in our moment-to-moment life. Each moment is a birth and a death. A birth of a new moment is the death of that moment preceding the birth of the next moment, and on and on and on. These are multiple lifetimes. So this is a concept of time. And so, again, he says he'll use the word kalpa in the sense defined above. It's not mathematical. It's a mathematical exercise to try to expand your thinking about how you experience life. But it's all about the mental experience of your life. Moving on. There are persons who, throughout this period of a kalpa, manifest hatred toward the Buddha by carrying out various activities in the three categories of body, mouth, and mind. Such a person was Devadatta. And we know him from the Lotus Sutra stories, right? And previous, but certainly he figures prominently in the Lotus. So now there's going to be some information about who Devadatta is. Oh, it gets so dry. It's incredible. All right. The Buddha was the son and heir of King Suddhodana. And Devadatta was the son of King Dronodana. These two kings were brothers. So Devadatta was a cousin of the Buddha. So Shakyamuni and Devadatta. In the present, as in the past, among sages as among ordinary men, trouble arising over a woman has been one of the prime causes of enmity. Ah, women. When Shakyamuni, thus come one, was still known as Prince Siddhartha, and Devadatta had been designated prince and heir to his father, it happened that a high minister named Yasha had a daughter named Yashodhara. She was the most beautiful woman in all of the five regions of India, a veritable goddess whose fame was known throughout the four seas. Of course she was. Siddhartha and Devadatta vied with each other to win her hand in marriage. Hence, discord arose between them. It's a Lifetime movie. All right. Later, Siddhartha left his family and became a monk. Actually, became Buddha. A Buddha. And Devadatta, taking the monk Suddhodaya as his teacher, left his family to become a monk. The Buddha observed the 250 precepts and abided by the 3,000 rules of conduct so that all heavenly and human beings looked up to him with admiration and the four kinds of believers honored and revered him. Devadatta, however, did not command such respect from others. So he began to consider whether there was not some way he could gain worldly fame that would surpass that of the Buddha. Petty jealousies, right? He came across five criteria by which he might surpass the Buddha and gain recognition from society. As noted in the fourfold rules of discipline, they were: 1. To wear robes of rags. 2. To seek food only by begging. 3. To eat only one meal a day. And 4. To sit out always in the open. And 5. To take neither salt nor the five flavors. So these were privations, early privations of monk practice, right? The Buddha would accept robes given to him by others, but Devadatta wore only robes made of rags. His motivation being to garner more attention than the Buddha. The Buddha would accept meals that were served to him, but Devadatta lived on alms alone. The Buddha would eat once, twice, or sometimes three times a day, but Devadatta, he would eat only once. The Buddha would take shelter in graveyards or under trees, but Devadatta sat out in the open all day long. The Buddha would, on occasion, consent to take salt or the five flavors, but Devadatta accepted none of them. And because Devadatta observed these rules, people came to believe that he was far superior to the Buddha. I guess he was right. And that they were as far apart as clouds and mud. So Devadatta did all of this out of jealousy, right? In this way, Devadatta sought to deprive the Buddha of his standing. The Buddha was supported by the lay believer King Bimbisara. Every day, the king supplied 500 cartloads of alms to the Buddha as well as to his disciples, doing so over a period of years without missing a single day. So a lot of support from the local powerful people, in this case, King Bimbisara. Devadatta, jealous of such devotion and hoping to secure it for himself, won Prince Enemy Before Birth over to his side and persuaded him to kill his father, King Bimbisara. It's pretty intense. He himself set out to kill the Buddha, hurling a rock and striking the Buddha with it. Such was the deed he carried out with his body. In addition, he slandered and cursed the Buddha, calling him a liar and a deceiver. Such was the deed he committed with his mouth. And in his heart, he thought of the Buddha as a foe from his previous lifetime, or again, over a woman. Such was the deed he engaged in with his mind. The great evil of these three interacting deeds has never been surpassed. Suppose that a terribly evil man like Devadatta were to engage in these three types of deeds and for an entire medium kalpa curse and revile Shakyamuni Buddha, striking him with staves and behaving toward him with jealousy and envy. The enormous guilt he would incur would be weighty indeed. This great earth of ours is 168,000 yohanas thick, and therefore it is capable of supporting the waters of the four great seas, the dirt and stones of the nine mountains, every kind of plant and tree, and all living beings without ever collapsing, tipping, or breaking apart. And yet, when Devadatta, a human being whose body measures 5 feet, committed no more than 3 cardinal sins, the great earth broke open and he fell into hell. The hole through which he fell still exists in India. The Tripitaka master Xuanzang stated in the text known as the Record of the Western Regions that when he journeyed from China to India for the sake of his practice, he saw it there. However, it is said that if one neither at heart thinks ill of the votary of the Lotus Sutra in the latter age, nor in one's bearing shows any envy toward him, but merely reviles him in a joking manner, then the consequences will be even worse than those brought about by Devadatta, when, by committing the 3 types of deeds, he cursed and reviled the Buddha for an entire medium kalpa. How much worse, then, would the consequences be if the people of the present age were to set about conducting themselves like Devadatta, carrying out these 3 types of deeds with truly evil hearts over a period of many years, cursing and reviling the votary of the Lotus Sutra, subjecting him to defamation and insult, envying and feeling jealous of him, beating and striking him, putting him to death under false charges, and murdering him. So, evidently all of this is about bolstering this young monk and preparing him for the kinds of offenses he may be witnessing in the people around him. He may be vilified in this way. He may, but it's important for him to understand the consequences of those acts, right? Not only for himself, but as he helps and aids others on their Buddha way, on their path. So now, as he's wont to do in these types of letters, he breaks into his question and answer. You know, they didn't have email or internet, obviously. They didn't even have the U.S. Postal Service or anything like it. So, you know, the way they sent messages to one another was through couriers who had to travel great distances on foot or on mules and horses. But terrain was pretty bad, no roads. So I think part of Nichiren's adopting this question and answer format is to somehow try to offer to the recipient of his letter some engagement, more intimate engagement of possible thoughts and answers to those thoughts. So the Nichiren didn't just ramble on, but he could kind of label the question or the subject that he wanted to address for the letter's recipient, right? So, question, and where are we on time? Not bad. Okay, question. When someone displays animosity toward the votary of the Lotus Sutra in this latter age, what hell will that person fall into? That's an interesting question. Moreover, you know, how serious is the offense? Answer. The second volume of the Lotus Sutra states, if a person should slander a sutra such as this, or on seeing those who read, recite, copy, and uphold this sutra, should despise, hate, envy, or bear grudges against them, .. when his life comes to an end, he will enter the Avicii hell. He can be confined there for a whole kalpa, and when the kalpa ends, die there again. He will keep repeating this cycle for countless numbers of kalpas. So, it's pretty severe. If somebody were to vilify you for your Buddhist practice of the Lotus Sutra specifically, they would be ensuring a lot of misery for themselves, and that's through no actions of your own. That's the kind of action, the kind of self-destructive act that they're doing albeit ignorant, even if they're practicing Buddhists of other sects and do this, they still are ignorant because they're ignorant of the ultimate teachings of the Lotus Sutra. But it's more grave an offense for those in the time of Nichiren who all know Buddhism to then vilify another Buddhist, period. But certainly the votary of the Lotus Sutra, and that's his point here. 500 Yohanas beneath the surface of the earth is the place of King Yama. And 1,500 Yohanas beneath the place of King Yama are the eight great hells and the rest of the 136 hells, Slotta Hells. Of these 136 hells, 128 are for the consignment of persons who have committed minor offenses. The eight great hells are for those who have committed grave offenses. Of the eight great hells, seven are for people who have committed the 10 evil acts. The eighth hell, the hell of incessant suffering, is for the consignment of three types of persons: those who have committed the five cardinal sins, those who have been unfilial, and those who have slandered the law. And the law is Myoho Renge Kyo. The passage I've just quoted makes it clear that people who curse, revile, or slander the votary of the Lotus Sutra in this latter age, even if they do so merely in jest, will fall into this hell. The Teacher of the Law chapter in the fourth volume of the Lotus Sutra states, quote, if there is someone who seeks the Buddha way, and for the space of a kalpa presses palms together in my presence and recites numberless verses of praise, because of these praises of the Buddha, he will gain immeasurable blessings. And if one lauds and extols those who uphold this sutra, one's good fortune will be even greater. The great teacher Miao Lo remarked, quote, those who vex or trouble the practitioners of the Lotus Sutra will have their heads split into seven pieces, but those who give alms to them will enjoy good fortune surpassing the 10 honorable titles. So this has a lot to do with being a practitioner of the law, right? And he's talking to a teaching monk. So he's reminding him not only for himself, but this perspective applies to your sangha, to your students. We'll go on here. Among human beings, the foremost is the ruler known as the wheel-turning king. When a wheel-turning king is about to appear in the world, an omen precedes him. A huge tree known as an adambara growing up in the midst of the ocean, bearing flowers and fruit. When a gold wheel-turning king appears, the mountains and seas of the four continents become level. The great earth becomes soft as cotton, the seas become sweet as amrita, and the mountains become mountains of gold, and the plants and trees turn into the seven kinds of treasures. This is all perceptive, remember? This is about experience, not actualness, not materialness. The wheel-turning king can travel throughout the entirety of the four continents in an instant. Therefore, the heavenly gods guard and protect him. The spirits gather around and serve him, and the dragon kings cause rain to fall at the proper time. If ordinary people of inferior capacity follow such a ruler, then they too can travel throughout the four continents in an instant. All of these things come about slowly because the wheel-turning king abides by the 10 good precepts. They are the rewards that results from that observance. So this is all about practice, right? If somebody is practicing correctly, then all of the people who practice with that person also gain the benefits of practicing correctly, and everybody wins. But this takes time because you have to constantly be vigilant about the monkey mind, right? So this is, again, advice to this teaching monk as well as it is advice to all of his students. Incomparably superior to the wheel-turning kings are Vaishravana, and the rest of the four heavenly kings. These are the great kings who preside freely over the four continents. Shakara is the lord of the heaven of the 33 gods. The devil king of the sixth heaven dwells at the summit of the world of desire and rules over the threefold world. Dairakutenumau. These beings were able to obtain their positions because they observed the highest class of the 10 good precepts and carried out the highly virtuous act of making impartial offerings. The great heavenly king Brahma is the most highly honored among the heavenly beings in the threefold world. He dwells at the summit of the world of form, is attended by the devil king of the sixth heaven and Shakara, and holds a major world system in his hand. In addition to having practiced the kind of meditation that is still accompanied by illusions, he has cultivated the four infinite virtues, pity, compassion, joy, and impartiality. The voice hearers is one like Shariputra or Mahakashyapa, who, in addition to observing the 250 precepts and practicing meditation without illusions, has concentrated his attention on the concepts of suffering, emptiness, impermanence, and non-self. He has cut off all the illusions of thought and desire arising in the threefold world and can move entirely at liberty through water or fire. For these reasons, he has Brahma and Shakara as his attendants. So see, he's superior, because he's dropping the illusions. The cause awakened one is one who is incomparably superior to the voice hearer, one whose advent in the world rivals that of a Buddha. Now you see, he's describing these different states of enlightenment. If you haven't caught that yet, coming from the Brahma world, he explains the chakra, sixth heaven, all these other really ancient Vedic gods, and how they're still wrapped up in illusions. The next step up is the voice hearer, which for us is the, was it the eighth? No. The sixth world? The world of learning? And now the cause awakened one, the world of realization, is the eighth world. So yeah, so the voice hearers is the seventh world. Silly boy. All right, so the cause awakened ones, or the world of learning, realization, sorry. Anyway, long ago, there was a hunter who lived in an age of famine. At that time, he gave a bowl of food consisting of millet as an offering to a Pratyeka Buddha named Rida. As a result, this hunter was reborn as a rich man in the human and heavenly realms for a period of 91 kalpas. In our present world, he was called Aniruddha and was known as the foremost in divine insight among the Buddha's disciples. So there's a whole, you can look that up as a separate story. There's a reference to it in the notes. The great teacher Miao Lo commented on this as follows, quote, "A meal of millet is a trifling thing, but because the donor gave all that he possessed and because the recipient was a superior being, the donor was able to obtain marvelous recompense," end quote. So you can see these are all fables or stories that are repeated in order to understand our mental experience of life and how it's colored by the actions or attitudes that we have. I've said it before, Buddhism is tremendously focused on intent and how your mind is developing intent, how it maintains intent, how it comes to arrive at intent. All of that is the subject of Buddhism. Moving on, the meaning of this passage of commentary is that though a meal of millet may be insignificant because it was given as an offering to a Pratyeka Buddha, a person of great worth, the donor was reborn again and again with wonderful rewards. So this is in the West what we would call the joys of giving, right? Although the construct, the mental construct, and the purpose and reward for it are very different, really. But the concept is still, it, in a simplistic way, sounds very similar, right? Next are those known as bodhisattvas, represented by Manjushri and Maitreya. These great bodhisattvas are remarkable beings who are incomparably superior to the Pratyeka Buddhas, the world of realization. Buddhas are beings who have completely dispelled the darkness associated with the 42 levels of ignorance and have attained the stage of perfect enlightenment. They are like the full moon on the 15th day night of the 8th month. These bodhisattvas have dispelled the darkness of 41 levels of ignorance, thus reaching the mountain summit of near-perfect enlightenment. The next to the last stage, they are like the moon on the 14th night. So understand this. They have 14th. And have attained the stage of perfect enlightenment. And in the next sentence, these bodhisattvas have dispelled the darkness, 41 levels, blah, 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 and thus reaching the mountain summit of near perfect enlightenment. So how can you say these two things in the same paragraph, right? It's important to understand that Buddhahood or Buddha-ness is something we're all capable of experiencing because we're already in it. But mentally, we have these obstacles, right? Ego, attachment, self, all of that. And if we can cease the formation of those attachments, they're still there, but we're no longer attached to the attachments because we're still human. The point is we experience Buddha in this life, in this form, in this human life. But because Buddha-ness is such a lofty thing, that to stay in Buddha-ness is to remain so disconnected from this mundane earthly body, that it has both the feature of being outside of samsara while still maintaining presence in samsara. This is the nirvana thing. So perfect enlightenment is the Buddha. Near perfect enlightenment is the Buddha way. It's the Bodhisattva way. Constantly in reverence to and in determination to maintain the Buddha way. And to do that requires Buddha wisdom. All of that experienced here and now in this human, samsaric, decidedly unenlightened form. Because enlightenment doesn't happen in form. It happens in mind. So where can you hold mind? Does the mind have a physical attribute? No, it does not. But the mind can only be experienced in this physical attribute, body thing, vessel that enables us to experience it. This can be very confusing, and I say all of this and I'm trying to dissect it, but this is the very thing that Shakyamuni says, really, you can only understand these concepts fully between Buddhas. Only when you experience Buddha-ness can you sense Buddha-ness. If you're not in Buddha-ness, then everything you do should be directed at awakening that Buddha-ness. But you can only do that while you're a human person, a human samsaric entity. So this it's it, it seems like a bit of a conundrum, but truly, if you do awaken your Buddha nature, it alters the way your samsaric personage experiences life. This is why we return to this fundamental point of Buddhism, that Buddhism is about living this life well, excellently, be an excellent being. Because by following the Buddha way with the Bodhisattva path, we are focused, laser resolved to maintain this Buddha insight, this Buddha-ness. Follow? So the language here, if you don't have a grasp of that idea, seems contradictory. Like, oh, is that a typo? How could you be perfectly enlightened and then near perfect enlightenment at the same time? What's going on there? Does this make sense? So let's go on and see if there are any more clues to this. The Buddha, now we've gone from Bodhisattva to Buddha, is 100,000, 10,000 million times superior to the various beings described above. A Buddha is invariably distinguished by 32 features. Among these features are a pure and far-reaching voice, an unseen crown of the head, a knot of flesh on the head like a top knot, a tuft of white hair between the eyebrows, and markings of the thousand-spoked wheel on the sole of each foot. Of these 32 features, each one was acquired as the result of 100 blessings. What do we mean by 100 blessings? Let us suppose that all the people in Japan, in China, and in 16 great states, the 500 middle-sized states, and the 10,000 small states that all make up the five regions of India are blind. Indeed, that all living beings throughout the continent of Japudvipa, the four continents, the six heavens of the world of desire, and throughout the entire major world system become blind. And let us suppose that there is a great physician who is capable of bestowing a splendid benefit by restoring sight to, in one instant, the eyes of all these beings. That act would count as the bestowal of a single blessing. When 100 such blessings are accumulated, it leads to the appearance of one of the 32 features. Buddhist math. From this, it is apparent that the benefits represented by merely one of these features are greater in number than all the plants and trees within a major world system, or all the drops of rain that fall upon the four continents. In the time of the Kalpa of decline, a great wind, known as Samgata, arises, uprooting Mount Sumeru, lifting it to the highest heaven in the world of form, and then reducing it to particles of dust. But despite all that, not a single hair on the body of the Buddha so much as stirs. In the breast of the Buddha is a great fire, made up of the great wisdom of equality, the shining light of great knowledge, and the fire pit of meditation. When the Buddha enters nirvana, this great fire blazes forth from his breast and consumes his body. Though the heavenly deities and the dragons and other beings of the six heavens of the world of desire and the four seas, distressed at the thought of losing the Buddha, gather round and cause torrential rains to fall until the earth of the entire major world system is underwater and Mount Sumeru is about to be washed away, still they cannot put out this huge fire. The Buddha is thus a person of great virtue. But King Ajatashatru, gathering together evil men from the 16 great states of India, plotting with non-Buddhists from all around, and acknowledging Devadatta as his teacher, turned numberless hordes of evil people loose, causing them to curse, attack, and kill the Buddha's disciples. Not only that, but he turned against his father, a worthy ruler who was guilty of no fault, pinning him down in 7 places with foot-long spikes. He also approached the queen consort, the mother who gave him birth, snatched away her jeweled hairpins, and held a sword to her head. Because of these terrible crimes, his body broke out in virulent sores in 7 places. It was fated that when 21 days had passed, on the 7th day of the 3rd month, the earth would break open and he would fall into the hell of incessant suffering to remain there for an entire kalpa. But because he sought out the Buddha, not only did his sores heal, but he was able to escape from the pains of the hell of incessant suffering and to live 40 years longer. So this is a story again from the sutra. The high minister, one more paragraph here. The high minister Jivaka was an emissary of the Buddha, and as a result, he was able to step into the flames and rescue the son of a rich man of Champa. Another famous story. From this, it would appear that once one has made offerings and paid homage to the Buddha, regardless of whether one is an evildoer or a woman, a lowly woman, one will be able to, without fail, to attain Buddhahood and achieve the way. So, I don't know where you are in your practice, but I can tell you that all of this that Nichiren has said thus far is like a refresher course for all of these expedient means, these skillful stories, rife with meaning, meant as teachings. And when we talk about Buddhist teachings, that's essentially what we're talking about, is all of these different sutras and commentaries. They're all in story form like this. And he's glossing over them rather quickly here. So you might want to pursue each of those more deeply. But understand the reason he's glossing over them is because of who he's talking to. Somebody who's been practicing for some 11 years or so, or 15 years, I think, since before he wrote this letter to him. Because of his responsibility, not Nichiren's, but Horen's responsibility as a teacher for others, right? So he's given him tools. I found it interesting that he spoke about these different worlds. He didn't label them so, but that's what he was talking about. Buddhahood, Bodhisattva, voice hearers, cause awakened ones, pratyaka buddhas, the lay believers, so on and so forth. This is interesting because he's laying out the groundwork to explain the different life conditions that we all experience, and that they are interdependent, because there's a Buddha of hell, there's a voice hearer of bodhisattva, there's a hunger of learning, so on and so forth. They all intermingle constantly, right? I've read some estimates of 180,000 decisions made in every moment of life. Those decisions are traveling between worlds, life conditions, ideas and thoughts and emotions, right? So interesting Gosho so far. A slightly different form than we've seen in the past thus far. But as I said, it's kind of a lengthy letter. So we're going to mutate into different parts of Nichiren's teachings here as we continue. But for today, that's part one of Letter to Horen. And I look forward to seeing you in the next one. Of course, comments below. Your participation is so greatly appreciated. Namo myoho renge kyo. And as you know, this is transcribed into podcasts, so you can get that anywhere. Donate if you can. And this is a donation of your time, so I consider that very valuable as well. Thanks. See you in the next one. Namo myoho renge kyo.